evening we're going to begin Romans chapter 10. We more or less finished up the first chapter of this three-chapter segment where Paul was dealing with the larger issues of God's dealings with Jews and Gentiles. And he ended the text in chapter 9 in kind of a critical way regarding the Jews, because he says that they didn't attain the righteousness that they were seeking because they were not pursuing it properly. And the question of why they didn't pursue it properly was because they stumbled over the stumbling stone that had been laid in Zion. It was a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense. And it had to do with some of the most basic issues that we have to deal with if we're going to relate to God. And those most basic issues have to do with what we're like and what he's like. And his description of our character is a stumbling stone to many people because it's a negative description and it offends our pride. And that's what happened with Israel. Israel had been given a law of righteousness, and they had turned it from a revelation of the truth about the righteousness of God into a methodology of redemption. We keep these rules and laws, and then God will reward us for our meritorious behavior, and by our works we'll enter into his kingdom. And Paul's gospel comes along and says, there's not one good, not even one. There's none that seeks after God. You Jews boast in the law, and you offend the Gentiles enormously by your hypocrisy, and they curse your God and blaspheme because of your behavior. And so his gospel was humiliating, and it is, because it says we're sinners and in need of redemption and forgiveness and a whole lot of stuff, and the Jews didn't want to hear that. So he ends up with this relatively negative statement about the Jews, and that kind of opens the door to the next chapter. In chapter 9, Paul was arguing at the beginning of the chapter that his love for his brethren according to the flesh made him willing to be sacrificed for their redemption. He said he'd be willing to be accursed from Christ for their sake, if it would do any good. It was a parenthesis that's not written, but it's understood. But that is a reflection. Paul's love for Israel is a reflection of God's love for Israel. So, in a very real sense, he was just mimicking the theology that he preached. But the Jews didn't believe it, and they accused Paul of not liking them, of, in effect, hating them, because at the end of chapter 8, he had been talking about these heavy themes of God's gracious sovereign choices and all that kind of thing, and the Jews came out on the short end of that. So as Paul began to develop this truth about God's larger plan to make himself more clearly known, he's going to make his wrath and power known, Paul says, and that explains why there are people who are vessels of wrath and there are other people who are vessels of mercy. And in the vessels of wrath and mercy, there are Gentiles and Jews, and there are Gentiles and Jews. The Jews, however, had already convinced themselves that they were the automatic vessels of mercy and the Gentiles were the vessels of wrath. And Paul said, no, it's not how it's measured. So, in a sense, Israel came out on the short end of the large issue of receiving benefit from the grace of God, because in effect Paul is saying you Jews are not going to have this special place anymore, for a while anyway. God is operating on a basis of grace and promise faith, and you guys are operating on the basis of the law and demand performance, and the two can't meet except at Calvary. So the conclusion of that line of thought is that Israel had no special superior moral claim to the God because of an innate and aggressive depravity that affected them, that they didn't want to admit. And barring special intervention by God, they have, according to Paul's statement here, they would have become as Sodom and Gomorrah in terms of both moral character and consequence. And, of course, Israel didn't want to believe that they were bad enough to be compared to Sodom and Gomorrah. So this was an indictment, in a sense, of Israel by Paul. And it was so repugnant to the pride and self-righteousness of the Jews that they were convinced that Paul simply hated them. And when he claimed that he loved them, he was just lying. And if they could believe that he was lying, then they could believe that his hatred for them was driving the development of his theology. So then they could just dismiss his gospel as the delusions of a hateful man. That actually happened to me once. I had written a rebuttal of the pre-wrath rapture view, and later on I had just looked at the web and to see what kind of responses there might have been given on the website for the pre-wrath rapture thing. And in that conversation that I saw on there, one of the pre-wrath supporters asked if anybody had ever responded to my refutation of their position. And the main guy on the website said, "Nah, he's just an angry man. I don't read stuff by angry men." That's the easy way out. You don't have to deal with any of the details. You just say, well, and that's what the Jews are doing. This Saul of Tarsus hates us, and he's making these hateful comments about us, and that just proves that his attitude is sorry. And that means that you don't have to believe his gospel, because the truth can't come out of a hateful heart. It's just the delusions of a hateful man. And so at the beginning of chapter 10, lo and behold, what do we run into? "Brethren, my heart's desire and my prayer to God for them," that is the people in Zion that have stumbled over the stumbling stone, "my heart's desire and prayer to God for them is for their salvation." He's come right back to his attitude toward Jews, which is how he started chapter 9. So basically, he's returning to this earlier thesis about his attitude toward his kinsmen according to the flesh as an attitude of positive love, positive concern, positive desire. Even though he has to tell them the truth, it doesn't mean that he hates them. It just means this is the way it is. You need to buy into it as a part of the beginning of your understanding of the truth about God and the gospel that offers you eternal life. So he sets out another set of arguments that put Israel in a bad light as to their moral character here in chapter 10. He says they have a zeal for God, but it's ignorant. He didn't say it exactly that way. He said it was not in accordance with knowledge, but that's what ignorance is. And he said, not knowing about the righteousness of God, they seek to establish their own, and they, as a consequence, wouldn't subject themselves to the righteousness of God. So in another sense, in chapter 10, he's again reinforcing the split between the natural assumption of fallen people. Fallen people tend to think that if you say something bad about them, you don't like them. That's just the natural pride reaction. And Paul is saying that's not true. I have to tell you the truth about yourself so that you can understand the truth about God and the good news that he's offering to you in spite of how you are. And it doesn't mean I don't like you. So, in a sense, this is Paul's second claim of genuine goodwill in respect to Israel. "My heart's desire and prayer to God for them is for their salvation." But I want you to notice that the opening word of verse 10, or verse 1 of chapter 10, is "brethren." And what that signifies is that he's writing these words of profession of positive attitude toward Israel, not to Israel. He's writing them to his fellow believers in Rome. And they're the ones who are going to get the letter, and they're going to read about his attitude, and that's going to do a couple or three things that are involved in this statement. One of them is that it's a tacit admission on his part that he clearly understood how the Jews hated him and were not likely to accept any protestations on his part that he was only seeking good for them. You can tell a person whose ego has severely been out of shape, he stumbled over the stumbling stone and he's been scandalized by the rock of scandal. You can tell him you like him while you're telling him how bad he is, and he isn't going to believe it. He's just not going to believe it, because they just automatically assume if you say something negative about me, it's because you hate me. Well, Paul recognized that the Jews hated him and therefore were not likely to believe any protestations he made, that he really prayed for them and wanted good for them. But it was also a tacit admission, if not a just direct statement, that the power of the argument of the Jews had in it the possibility that the brethren would be influenced by their argument and therefore be turned away from faith in the gospel. In other words, their argument was this: you can't be preaching the truth of God out of a hateful heart, and it's obvious that Saul of Tarsus hates us. He wouldn't say these hateful things about us if he didn't hate us. And if he hates us, you can just dismiss his gospel as unwarranted. It's not true. There's a bunch of, it's just flowery religious language. And Paul, by saying to the brethren, look, my heart's desire, my prayer to God for them is for them to be saved. He says that to them, like everything he says to them, to address the possibility of a vacillation of faith on their part. The Jews wanted Paul's disciples to abandon his gospel. They aggressively attempted to dissuade them from believing it, just like they did in Galatia. So, Paul, understanding that sometimes faulty arguments sound true enough to get people that believe the truth to be not quite so confident that it's true any longer. I mean, what would you say? Yeah, you can believe the truth of a hateful heart. You can believe the gospel that comes out of the heart of a hateful man. Yeah, you can. No, you can't. You're on the weak side of that argument if you say, yeah, you can. Because hate doesn't generate confidence. It doesn't generate a strong indication that this is truth. So, there are two major issues, I think, underneath that idea that the believers in Rome might have been swayed to some degree by Paul's adversaries as they accused him of hating them. And the first is, in the two issues of the heart, or at the heart of these accusations, is number one, love. What do you love? And what was Saul of Tarsus loving when he says all these hateful things about us? And that love is the issue of the heart. The heart, as far as I'm concerned in the scriptures, is a metaphor for the core of your value system. It may have some other implications and things that fit in some other directions, but basically, your heart is the center of the core of your value system. That's where you value everything you value, and because the values set the stage for all the choices that we make, including what we're going to believe. The Proverbs say, guard your heart with all diligence, because out of it are the issues of life. What you value is going to govern even what you choose to believe. Because Jesus said to the Pharisees, how can you believe when you have set in your heart a goal to obtain the glory of men and you don't even care whether God is satisfied with you or not? You don't seek the glory that God has to offer. You seek the glory of men, and that's keeping you from believing the truth. So Jesus, in effect, taught that love's the foundation. What a person loves governs what he's going to be willing to believe. And that leads us to the second major issue, and that's the faith. Because it is the faith that draws the power of all the choices that we make. We don't make choices without believing things. But the believing is rooted in the objectives which are in the value system. If you love something, then you're going to try to pursue that thing that you love. And the question of love is, why do you value it? And the question of faith is, how are you going to get it? So faith is a methodological issue. It's the question of, well, how are you going to pursue this? You're going to do it this way? You're going to do it this way? How are you going to do it? And in this chapter, Paul says, they're seeking righteousness and not getting it because they have a zeal for God, but it's ignorant and therefore twisted. So you have these faith-love things. And in fact, somebody asked me last Tuesday night why a certain group of people believe the doctrine that they believe. And I said, because of hidden agendas of the heart. We don't know our hearts. They're deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. And until God actively changes that, we are driven by many values that we hold that we never even question. We just do stuff because that's going to fulfill the objectives of our hearts. And we may not even know what's really driving it, but something's driving it. And I'm convinced that all bad theology is driven by false agendas of the heart. People believe what they want to believe because the heart's demanding that they believe that so that they can pursue it and achieve this objective. Now, and I believe that's one of the reasons we have as many variations in theology, even among Christians, as we have. It's not because God isn't willing to lead us all into all the truth. It's because the leading has to overcome a whole bunch of junk in our hearts. And because it has to overcome, it takes a long time. I don't think that we're all going to be led into all the truth until we see Jesus face to face. Then we'll all believe the same thing. But until then, He's going to be dealing with us about the issues of our hearts and the things that we choose to believe because of those issues. And as a consequence, we're not going to agree with each other on a lot of stuff because we've got a different agenda and a different methodology. Well, those are fundamental issues, and it's an issue that Paul constantly is dealing with in all of his writings. His goal is love with a legitimate faith to follow it. That's always his goal. So he's always challenging the values of our hearts, and he's always informing us of a better methodology for chasing them than the legal one. So if the Christians in Rome, who were Paul's object of effort, he's writing this letter to believers in Rome, if those people could be persuaded by the Jews, the adversaries, that Paul had a very unhealthy attitude in his core values concerning the Jews, then the logic of the Jews in their opposition to Paul would take root. You can't argue that good, solid truth doctrine comes out of a heart that's driven by hateful objectives. You can't argue that. So if they can persuade the believers that Paul's root objectives are to get even with the Jews for all their persecution or whatever, whatever he supposedly hates them, if they can get them to believe that Paul's driven by hatred, well, then they've got him. Their confidence in the gospel will just die. So the Jews would argue that bad theology comes out of a bad heart. But they make this argument with the most massive blindness. Because if there was anybody in this mix that hated somebody, it was the Jews who hated Paul. And yet they're trying to argue that his theology can't be right because he hates them. And they never even dream that their theology can't be right because they hate him. And there isn't any question about the fact that they hate him. They're trying to kill him actively. So it's not about whether the Jews are protesting, "Oh, Paul, we love you. We really don't hate you. We're just saying these bad things about you because they're true and you need to deal with it." That's not their argument. They're trying to kill him. They're trying to get the Romans to kill him. And so there's no debate about the fact that they hate him. And so their argument turns against them. It's an amazing thing. This massive lack of self-awareness, it's part of the human condition. We all are possessed of it. We all are blind to our own issues while we're very sharp on others. And we'll condemn others for doing the very same thing we do. That's Romans chapter 2. But Paul has got a better foundation for declaring his positive attitude toward the Jews than the Jews have for Paul, because they can't deny they hate him. They can't deny they're trying to get him killed. It's obvious. Their hatred for him is violent, and it's unlawful. I mean, even Jesus, when they hated Jesus enough to try to get him put to death, they broke so many of their own laws in the process of trying to force Pilate into crucifying Jesus of Nazareth, that there was no way under the sun that they could actively argue that we're doing what's right. I mean, anybody watching it would say, even Pilate said, they're just doing this because they're jealous. Everybody watching without something invested in the observation would say, those guys hate him. And the Jews couldn't deny it. They hated him. So to argue that his theology was false because it was driven by hate actually destroyed their own theology. You know, it's like the guy that says there are no absolutes. And you say, is that an absolute statement? The declaration by itself is self-destructive. And that's exactly. A hate-driven theology is untrustworthy. And no one wishing to know the truth could be successful by following a theology rooted in hate. It is untrustworthy. But who's the untrustworthy one here? Paul, on his side, says, hey, I will be accursed for them, from Christ, for their sake. And here he says, my heart's desire and my prayer to God is for their salvation. They can say, you're lying, but they can't say he didn't say the words. He's making the claim. So, if the Christians could be persuaded by the Jews of the folly of Paul's theology, then the entire work of God in their case would be thwarted, because you have to live by faith if you're going to be involved in the process of all that God wants to do for you. You have to believe him. And if your faith falters, you can't claim to be believing. And if you're not believing, then you're operating out of the flesh. It's a mess. So, in that regard, Paul's claim to genuine goodwill in respect to the Jews is not only addressed to the brethren and for their sake. He wants the brethren to believe that he loves the Jews, even if the Jews don't. But it also contains this strong declaration that it's Paul's heart that is not driven for hatred for the Jews, even though his teaching about them and their moral character has put them in a bad light. He doesn't say, my desire is for their salvation. He says, my heart's desire. And he is deliberately pulling this issue of the metaphor of the heart being the core of your value system right into the middle of this. He is saying, look, the Jews don't believe I love them. In fact, some of you may not believe I love them, because I just got through saying they're arrogant, driven by ego, their pride has been bruised, they're stumbled over the rock of offense, you know. You may not believe I love them, but the fact is, at the core of my value system, in my own heart, my prayer at that place is that they might be saved. So, in that declaration, Paul chose to talk about one of the driving issues of his own heart, and that was his desire for Israel to be saved. But the word that's translated desire, he says, my heart's desire, that's not the typical term for desire. If you were to look, for example, at Philippians 2:13, which is, I think, a most fundamental verse for the whole New Testament believer to walk by, it says in Philippians 2:13 that it is God who works in you both the desiring and the expenditure of energy in order to be able to fulfill His, God's, good pleasure. And the word desire in Philippians 2:13 is the typical term for desire, fellow. The thelema is the desire. That's the word Paul uses in 1 Timothy 2 when he says that God desires all men to be saved. That's not a desire he's going to put a lot of oof behind, but it is a legitimate, honest desire. Well, that's the issue, and Paul didn't say that it's his heart's desire. He used a word that's used in Philippians 2:13 about God wanting his good pleasure done. So he puts the desire and the effort into your heart so that you'll do what he desires for you to do. I think that's a terrific verse, because it basically is very sound theology. God knows what we're like. He knows what he's redeemed us from. He knows what his goal is in bringing us to perfection of moral character at the rapture when we see him. But in the meantime, he's dealing with fallen people whose values are messed up and their thoughts are messed up and their beliefs are messed up. And so what God knows is this: if I'm going to get anything out of them that I want to get out of them, I'm going to have to put it in them. It's kind of like Harvey Gaskamp used to say about the soil in East Texas. He was the county agent. He said, the soil in East Texas is a neutral medium. If you want anything out of it, you're going to have to put something into it, which meant fertilizer and lime. And that's the only way you're going to grow anything. Well, our hearts are not neutral. They're positively antagonistic to a lot of good. And in that antagonism, God knows that if he wants us to accomplish some good purpose, and he says in Ephesians 2:10 that he has created us in Christ Jesus unto good works, which he has before ordained that we should walk in them. So if he's going to get these good works done, Philippians 2:13 tells us how it's going to work. He's going to put in you the desire, and then he's going to affect the energy that's going to be used to motivate your body's activities, and then you'll do His good pleasure. And that's good theology. That's Acts 2, where the Holy Spirit's given in order to produce the fruit of the Spirit through our bodies into the life of the world. So, the issue that I'm making here is that the word that's translated desire in Romans 10:1 is the word that's translated good pleasure in Philippians 2:13. And it's that word. It's you, E-U, which means good. And then the word pleasure, which is not really pleasure, it's dokeo. And dokeo means something that appears to be because it's made to look a certain way. So it's often... Well, Jesus used this word, eudokeo, when he said, Father, I am grateful to you because it seemed good to you, that's our word, it seemed good to you to hide these things from the wise and understanding and reveal them to babes. God hid some of the most potent truths from those that considered themselves, and that's understood in Jesus' statement. They considered themselves wise and understanding, and that's why God hid it from them. But these babes who didn't have any wisdom and understanding, He revealed it to them, so they got it. And Jesus said, that makes me glad. I'm thankful to you, Father, that it seemed good to you to do this. And that's a text, by the way, that's used... Matthew 11:26, Matthew records it, and Luke 10:21, Luke records it. So apparently they thought that was a pretty significant statement. But the point of the statement is that God has a way of looking at things and says, this is a good thing. This appears to me to be good. Well, what appears to God to be good is stuff that comes right out of the heart of God. His value system is what decides whether it's good or not. And so if His heart says, this is a good thing, and He makes it clear that it's a good thing, other people can observe it and say, this is the good pleasure of God. Well, what is good pleasure? What is this seeming good thing? Well, basically, it's a description of an attitude where a thing that's considered to be good is caused to appear to be good. It is seen to be. And it's, therefore, it seems to be good. And so what Paul is saying is, brethren, my heart's good pleasure. The thing that is really good and should be pretty obvious from the behavior, because it had to be obvious to anybody who observed Paul in his preaching toward the Jews. Every place he went to the Jews first. He went into their synagogues and tried to persuade them that God had provided a redeemer for them. And if they would acknowledge their need for a Redeemer because of their sin, God would forgive them if they would put their trust in Jesus of Nazareth as the Redeemer. That was His message. The only hateful part about it was that they had to admit they were sinners in need of a Redeemer. And it was only their pride that kept them from being willing to do that. So it had to be obvious to anybody that watched Paul. He would go to the Jews and he would try to win them to belief in the God who loved them and was willing to provide a sacrifice for them, and Jesus was the sacrifice. And that's not a theology of hate. It's not the behavior of a hateful man. So, what Paul is actually saying is that the attitude of his heart in respect to Israel is not one of vindictive hatred. He would admit that they hated him and they were persecuting him and they had done all kinds of bad stuff to him, but he would at the same time deny that that had made his attitude toward them shift to one of vindictive revenge. He said, no, the good pleasure of my heart would be for them to be saved. So, by the declaration where he adds this qualifier, in my heart or of my heart, he is pulling the issue of the heart right into his argument. Because the Jews are saying your theology is false because your heart's bad. And he would say, the truth about my attitude toward you in my heart is that I wish you would be saved. So, by doing this, Paul is making the claim that at his core, at the core of his values, he is not antagonistic toward the Jews. He wants them to be saved. And in fact, in Romans 11, he's actually going to declare a situation in the future where all Israel will be saved, and it gives him great joy. So he really does want Israel to be saved. And in this declaration, Paul is making a huge distinction between his heart's values in regard to Israel and his willingness to state the truth about them as to their blind self-righteousness and moral depravity. In other words, just because I tell the truth about them doesn't mean I don't like them. Just because I say that they're too proud for their own good, that they stumbled over the stone of stumbling, doesn't mean that I don't wish they'd be saved. Because there's no necessary connection. That necessary connection's only in the eyes of a man who's driven by pride. You can't tell a proud man something bad about him and expect you to think that he likes you, that you like him. It's just automatic. So that's one of the big issues in this declaration. Paul says, my heart's desire is for their salvation. But then, the verse also reveals something about Paul's prayer life. Because he says, my prayer to God for them. My prayer to the God for them is that they might be saved. And this is interesting because there are several words in the New Testament for prayer. And by using the issue of prayer, Paul is indicating that this is how he's approaching the desire of his heart toward the Jews. He's asking the God to save them. But in choosing the particular word that he chose here, he intensifies the positive aspect of his attitude toward the Jews. He intensifies the positive aspect of his attitude. He really wants this to be done. Because the word that he uses, deesis, and it's used in context, for example, Luke writing his record about Zacharias and Elizabeth. When Gabriel shows up at the right hand of the altar there where Zacharias has gone in to put some incense on the altar and Gabriel's standing there, Gabriel tells Zacharias, don't be afraid. God has decided to answer your deesis for a son. It's like Abraham. This is what Zacharias wanted, a son really badly. In fact, he wanted it so badly that the fact that he didn't have one had turned him cynical toward God. Because as soon as Gabriel said, God's going to give you a son, he said, it can't happen. I'm too old. My wife's too old. If he wanted to give me a son, he should have done that a few years before when it was possible. I'm putting words in Zacharias' mouth, and I may one of these days have to explain to him why I said that about him. But the fact is, you use the word deesis in, there are several times in the context of the New Testament where this is an explanation of what's really in your heart. This is really what you want. I really want this. I really want a son, Zacharias would say. Or at least I did until I gave up hope because I got too old and my wife's too old. But I had made many prayers of this kind of intensity to God for a son. And now Gabriel's here telling me that God's heard those and is going to give it to me. But by using that word, well, and Paul used it in other contexts, for example, people who were longing for something, he would use the word deesis to express that longing. This is what they really wanted. So Paul is really just pulling the curtain back in regard to this question of what is your attitude toward these Jews? Are you saying these hateful things about them, quote unquote hateful, because you don't like them? Or because they're true and they need to come to grips with them in order for them to be saved? Because there's a huge difference in motivation there. And he's saying, look, my true deesis in regard to the Jews is for their salvation. That's what I really want. And then just like with his desire, he adds this qualifying phrase. He says, the desire of my heart. And now he says, the prayer to the God. The phrase, my prayer to the God, is a typical normal. I mean, who else are you going to pray to? But the idea is that adding the phraseology, my prayer to the God, it's, as I've already indicated, relatively unnecessary given the fact that if you really want something, you're going to go to the person you think you can get it from. And if your theology's got any validity to it at all, that means you're going to go to the executor of power, the final executor, the one who decides whether a thing will be or not. That's the person you go to ask if you really want something. If it doesn't really matter to you, you can talk to anybody about it. But if you really want something, you go to the ultimate executor of power and say, "Would it be possible for you to give me this?" Because the God is the ultimate executor. He's the one who decides what will and won't be, and he's got the power to make it happen because he's the executor of power. When omnipotence is behind the choices of the person that you're talking to, you've either got an excellent, positive outcome coming, or you've got an absolute no that isn't going to happen regardless. Because when you butt up against omnipotence, it's either going to be exercised for you or against you. And if it's omnipotence, there are no other options. You'll either get it or you won't. And Paul's deesis for the Jews was, I want them to be saved. The fact is, God's going to answer that prayer. But that is just a part of Paul's unveiling the attitude he has toward his brethren according to the flesh. He has this desire of his heart and his prayer to the God. But it also tells us that he wants them to be saved. That's the focus of his desire. And this issue of being saved is, as far as human beings are concerned, their highest good. If you gain the whole world, but your soul is not saved, you lose your soul, what have you got? Jesus asked that. Because you don't have anything. Without being rightly related or restored to a right relationship with God through the promise of eternal life, where you're going to be settled into a kingdom of righteousness, peace, and joy forever, if that's not the issue, then the issue is you're going to perish forever. And his goal, Paul's goal, was for them to have that positive outcome. He wanted them to be saved. He wanted their highest good. But it also explains this plainness of speech in chapter 9 regarding the Jews. Because the speech is negative. It describes them in distasteful ways. They're arrogant. They're stumbling over the stone of stumbling. They're being offended by the rock of offense. They have a zeal for God, but it's ignorant, and they are trying to set up their own righteousness. And these words are simply plain speech, because the Jews did want the glory of men on the basis of their performance of righteousness. And that actually makes their acts of righteousness unrighteous. It is a sin to do a right-looking thing for a wrong reason. It is not righteousness. You want to take an act of unrighteousness that looks like righteousness and impress somebody with it so they'll think highly of you. How's that for being confused? Well, they want to be known by their truth, but Paul says it's corrupted because of their own blindness. They're trying to tell you that my theology is bad because my heart's bad, and their hearts of hate toward me is indisputably true. Yeah, we can argue about whether I hate them or not, but you can't argue about whether they hate me. So, what's Paul's point? Well, on the one hand, for the sake of the Roman believers, he undercuts the argument of the Jews. They can't argue that his theology is bad because his heart's bad. They may believe it because of the accusation, but it's not necessary. They haven't proved it. And Paul says that's not true. My heart's desire and prayer to God for them is for them to be saved. So on that hand, he is reinforcing his readers' capability of continuing to believe his message, which is life-giving. But on the other, it makes it possible for his readers to begin to buy into the same kind of love-based values, because that's the example that Paul's setting for them. These Jews have persecuted him. They've tried to kill him. They've tried to undercut everything he's done. And his heart's desire and prayer to God is for them to be saved. So what should the Romans do under their settings of persecution and opposition and all that? The same thing Jesus said, love your enemies. Do good to them that despitefully use you. That's what Paul's making possible here. So he's actually enhancing the capability of the Jews, of the believers, the brethren, to live by faith and to develop in the love that is true love. So that's verse 1.